Today is January the 19th, 2022. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on www.prn.fm, streaming on the internet. If you have had problems signing on to prn.fm, try using prn.live, that's prn.live. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Microsoft to acquire Activision Blizzard for $68.7 billion. That's with a capital B. Activision Blizzard, the company was formed in 2008 through the merger of Activision and Vivendi, which was then the parent company of Blizzard. They helped pioneer online gaming through the Battle.net, which was the first online gaming service to be directly integrated into the games that used it. This made access to online gaming much easier and helped popularize Diablo and subsequent Blizzard games. Notable games include World of Warcraft, StarCraft, Diablo, Overwatch, and Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. Video games have become an irreplaceable part of our global culture. Microsoft says there are more than 2 billion gamers around the world, and they're all part of a rapidly growing global community. As an industry, video games generated almost $120 billion in revenue during 2018. This deal will bring Microsoft hundreds of millions of gamers. Microsoft is acquiring gaming giant Activision Blizzard in a deal worth just shy of $69 billion, which Microsoft says will allow it to gain access to hundreds of millions of gamers and position it as the world's third largest gaming company by revenue behind Tencent and Sony. In a press release, Microsoft put the total of the deal at $68.7 billion, adding Activision Blizzard is a leader in game development and interactive entertainment, content publisher with legendary games including Call of Duty, Candy Crush, Warcraft, Diablo, Overwatch, and Hearthstone. This acquisition will accelerate the growth in Microsoft's gaming business across mobile, PC, console, and cloud, and will provide building blocks for the metaverse. Microsoft wrote in the release that in addition to the 25 million subscribers in its cross-platform Game Pass service, which offers a rotating array of titles to both Xbox and PC gamers, the deal will give it access to Activision's Blizzard's nearly 400 million monthly active players in 190 countries and billion-dollar franchises. Microsoft added that when the deal goes through, it will have 30 internal game development studios. This is Microsoft's largest acquisition of all time, at well more than double its 2016 purchase of LinkedIn for $26 billion. Not all of Microsoft's expansion efforts have gone well, with stumbles in its attempt to get a slice of TikTok and unsuccessful attempts to buy social media, Pinterest, and chat app, Discord. Other gaming giants like Chinese conglomerate Tencent and Sony have made recent developer acquisitions, though theirs are far outstripped by the Activision Blizzard deal. Activision Blizzard owns gaming franchises ranging from Call of Duty to the World of Warcraft, and even Candy Crush. But it's gone through a serious rough patch lately after outcry over its treatment of its own employees. In July of 2021, the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing sued the company for rampant sexual harassment, and it reached a separate settlement with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission just last year. Microsoft previously acquired Bethesda, the publisher of Fallout and the Elder Scrolls series in a massive $7.5 billion deal last year. Gaming is the most dynamic and exciting category in entertainment across all platforms today, and will play a key role in the development of metaverse platforms. Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella wrote in a statement, "We're investing deeply in world-class content, community, and the cloud to usher in a new era of gaming that puts players and creators first and makes gaming safe, inclusive, and accessible to all." Activision Blizzard CEO Kotick added in the statement, "For more than 30 years, our incredibly talented teams have created some of the most successful games. The combination of Activision Blizzard's world-class talent and extraordinary franchises with Microsoft's technology, distribution, access to talent, ambitious vision, and shared commitment to gaming and inclusion will help ensure our continued success in an increasingly competitive industry." Hours after Microsoft says it's buying Activision, the United States government says it's overhauling merger guidelines. On the heels of Microsoft Activision purchase, the United States government's Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission launch a joint review of antitrust merger guidelines. The DOJ and FTC monitor and may investigate mergers and acquisitions, which, to put it very simply, could break antitrust laws, usually through anti-competitive or monopolistic arrangements. In a joint live stream earlier, FTC chair explained that FTC and DOJ are jointly launching a review of the merger guidelines to improve the ability of antitrust agencies to assess unlawful mergers and enforce regulations. The FTC said, "Recent evidence indicates that many industries across the economy are becoming more concentrated and less competitive, imperiling choice and economic gains for consumers, workers, entrepreneurs, and small businesses. These problems are likely to persist or worsen due to an ongoing merger surge that has more than doubled merger filings from 2020 to 2021. Activision CEO Bobby Kotick briefly touch on this sort of red tape in an interview, affirming that Microsoft will drive the bus, obviously on the antitrust issues, when asked about the implications of the deal. Firefox browser is suddenly failing to load websites. Firefox says the problem has now been resolved. Earlier, Firefox became unresponsive due to change in defaults by a cloud provider, which triggered a Firefox HTTP3 bug. "We disabled the configuration," they said, "and changed and confirmed this fixed the issue. If you're still affected, please restart your browser, and they're sorry for any inconvenience caused." A bizarre bug in Firefox has cropped up that means users of Firefox were unable to load any website in the Mac, Windows, and desktop Linux versions of the browser. Affected users are simply seeing the tab spin forever, never completing loading to show the page. This issue only affected selected websites and not all. Well, when I switch over to another browser, there was no problem. I can only conclude it was not a website issue. This had me perplexed. Now we've learned that it was caused by a Firefox problem. The underlying issue preventing pages from loading appears to be an infinite loop bug in Firefox HTTP3 implementation. This essentially causes the browser process to hang indefinitely. Luckily, very few real websites actually care about HTTP3, with almost everyone either still using older standards or providing a fallback. This means HTTP3 capability is not yet required to browse the modern web. The workaround to the bug then is to simply disable HTTP3 loading entirely in Firefox. This workaround applies to all desktop versions of Firefox, so it'll work regardless of whether you're on Windows and Mac. Of course, once the actual software bug has been resolved, you'll want to go back and re-enable HTTP3 so that you can use HTTP3 dependent services in the future. The iOS version of Firefox is not affected by the bug, as its underlying rendering engine is WebKit, the same as Safari. This is because on iOS, Apple does not allow third-party browsers to use their own engines for security reasons. Norton Antivirus adds CryptoMiner and takes a cut of the earnings. The digital currency is created through a process called CryptoMining. Many people have gone to great lengths to develop elaborate crypto mining operations, spending thousands of dollars on high-end machines that run day and night. When installing antivirus software, you expect it to protect against security threats. The last thing you want to find a package in the program is a crypto miner. Discovered by digital activist Cory Doctorow, it turns out that Norton's antivirus software now comes with a crypto miner. While you need to opt in for the miner to begin working, it is concerning. The miner springs into action when you are not using your device and sets up a secure wallet for you. As usual, there's no such thing as free money. While serving as the miner facilitator, Norton will take 15% off the top. Now, what you can do about it? You can only disable the mining, but not remove the module completely. Norton also takes complete control of the settings thresholds. The company explains at the bottom of a Q&A page that a 15% coin mining fee is charged. There are coin mining fees as well as transaction costs to transfer Ethereum. Transaction fees fluctuate due to cryptocurrency market conditions and other factors. Norton should be detecting and killing off crypto mining hijacking, not installing their own. What's to prevent Norton Antivirus from implementing other cryptic processing in your system? The simplest solution is to drop all current and future installation of Norton software. It is illogical that you would pay willingly for this type of software. Micron's new budget solid-state device. Micron has become the first company to ship 176-layer QLC NAND flash at volume, paving the way for higher capacity solid-state drives at lower price points. QLC is 4-bit level cells with much increased capacity, but transfer rates are slower and the endurance level is lower. According to Micron, 176-layer QLC NAND enables 33% higher I/O speeds and 24% lower read latency than its previous 96-layer QLC. The company expects these performance improvements to help triple the adoption of QLC in consumer markets by 2023. The groundbreaking NAND technology is set to feature predominantly in budget laptops and desktops, potentially eliminating one of the last remaining use cases for internal hard disk drives in the consumer space. Micron's 176-layer QLC NAND will be first showcased in the new Micron 2400 PCIe 4.0 NVMe solid-state device, which comes in three flavors, 512 gigabytes, 1 terabyte, and 2 terabyte. The company says the highest capacity model reaches sequential read speeds of 4.5 gigabytes and write speeds of 4 gigabytes per second, and random read writes of 650K and 700K IOPS, respectively. Although this level of performance doesn't come close to the most performance SSD on the market, the Micron 2400 outstrips even the fastest hard disk drives by a significant margin, supposedly at a competitive price point. The top SKU is also the world's only 2-terabyte SSD that comes in the minuscule 22x30mm M.2 form factor, which makes it very suitable for ultrabooks and ultra-thin and light laptops. More common 22x42 and 22x80 versions are also available. Micron's 2400 SSD builds upon the 176-layer NAND will significantly accelerate the adoption of QLC as it enables broader design options and more affordable capacity. Big tech? Did someone say big tech? Google, Facebook, CEO signed off on allegedly illegal ad deal. The antitrust lawsuit led by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton was filed in 2020 with an unredacted version coming to light just last week. The chief executives of Facebook and Google personally signed off on the deal that allegedly gave the social network an advantage in the search giant's online advertising auctions, according to a newly unredacted court filing. New details about the agreement, reported on Friday by the Wall Street Journal and Politico, come in an unredacted version of a multi-state antitrust lawsuit led by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton that was originally filed in 2020. Some elements of the ad deal, codenamed Jedi Blue, had previously been reported by the Wall Street Journal. The newly unsealed court document, however, alleges that Google CEO Sundar Pichai and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg were personally involved in approving the ad agreement, according to Politico. Since the lawsuit was filed, Facebook has rebranded its parent company as Meta. Meta isn't a defendant in this case. The original lawsuit accused Alphabet-owned Google of harming competitors by engaging in false, deceptive, or misleading acts while operating its online ad exchange. It also alleged that Facebook illegally teamed up with the search giant, one of its biggest competitors in digital advertising. Google spokesman Peter Schattenfels said that the lawsuit lacks merit and contains inaccuracies. He stated, "We sign hundreds of agreements every year and don't require CEO approval, and this was no different." Schattenfels said in an email, he added that Facebook is one of the more than 25 companies that participate in its ad bidding program. Facebook also defended the agreement in an email statement. A spokesperson for Meta said, "These business relationships enable Meta to deliver more value to advertisers." The unredacted version of a multi-state antitrust lawsuit has yet appeared to be available, however, in PACER, a database of federal lawsuits. In addition to the lawsuit filed by the Texas Attorney General, Google and Facebook are also facing lawsuits from over 30 publishers across the country that print more than 200 newspapers. These companies allege that the tech giants have been unfairly manipulating the advertising market and siphoning off revenue, crippling their businesses. The wave of litigation from publishers come as the U.S. Justice Department has also sued Google for allegedly violating antitrust laws, charging that the company has a monopoly in search and online advertising. Facebook is also facing action from the Federal Trade Commission over allegations the social media site maintains its dominance by acquiring or eliminating companies it sees as competitive threats. In searching through the web to see all the companies they acquire, they average the acquisition of one company a month. The alleged involvement of Google's and Facebook top executives in deals that publishers say have harmed their business is seen by some as further evidence that companies have deliberately worked to put smaller publishers out of business. The IRS, that's the Internal Revenue Service, targets payment transactions over $600 on Venmo, Etsy, and other sites. Starting this month, users selling goods and services through such popular sites as Venmo, Etsy, and Airbnb will be receiving tax forms if they take payment of more than $600. One by one in recent months, tech giants have been warning users of the coming changes and asking them to provide tax information. Until this year, the threshold was much higher, $20,000 and 200 transactions, so it didn't affect nearly as many people. Venmo told users in its messages about the change. This requirement only pertains to payments received for sales of goods and services and does not apply to friends and family payments. A record 5.4 million adults applied to form their own business last year, according to the U.S. Census Bureau data released this week. That's partly because it's easier than ever to use apps to sell crafts, provide services, or rent out a second or third floor online. The changes are at odds with President Joe Biden's vow to tax wealthy Americans. It's not coming from the billionaires, it's coming from the smaller businesses. Apps, marketplaces, and payment providers have long had to report certain payments to the Internal Revenue Service for any user that collected more than 200 transactions that totaled more than $20,000 in value in a given year. The new $600 threshold arrived last year as part of the American Rescue Plan, which the White House billed as a way to provide relief to small businesses hit hard by the pandemic. The move comes as the IRS has been thrown into chaos during the pandemic. A report this week from Taxpayer Advocates Service found depleted staffing and a lack of funding for the agency has caused high volume of unprocessed returns. Taxpayers are frustrated with the backlog and lack of communication from the IRS. The IRS is in crisis. As the IRS is preparing to begin the 2022 filing season, it is poised to carry over millions of unprocessed returns and millions of pieces of taxpayer correspondence, resulting in even longer delays for taxpayers who have been patiently waiting for far too long. And now, this new payment transactions over $600 is required. Canon shut down its major camera factory in China. Canon announces the full shutdown of its major plant located in China, the Zhuhai factory. The 32-year plant is the only production base for digital cameras, sensors, and lens among Canon's 15 companies in China. The decision may indicate Canon's intention to reduce the number of camera models and to focus on those with the highest margin level, which is the professional mirrorless. Canon is terminating its digital SLR flagship Canon EOS 1DX Mark III. Canon has announced to cut production at the Zhuhai factory. According to reports, Canon will close part of its Zhuhai factory in southern China, with a full shutdown of the 32-year plant being considered, due to shrinking demand in the digital camera market and the continued fallout from the coronavirus. Rumors about the closure of the entire factory facility in Guangdong province started last week with an internal company letter circulating online. The announcement, which was issued last week, said that the operation of the company is facing unprecedented difficulties despite the joint efforts of the company and all employees. It has failed to reverse the situation. The headquarters has to adjust the overall operation structure of the group. After careful consideration, a difficult decision has to be made to terminate the company's production. Furthermore, according to the statement, it is not clear how many employees at the Zhuhai factory will be affected, and the company has yet to decide whether the relevant production line will be relocated. As of the end of 2020, the Zhuhai factory had 1,317 employees, according to the company's website. Canon emphasizes that because of the development of the smartphone, the market for compact digital cameras has been shrinking. Other shocks include the pandemic and the shortage of semiconductor chips. It's worth mentioning that by the end of 2020, investment in Zhuhai subsidiary had reached $220 million with 1,317 employees. Its production of lens totaled 12.29 million in 2020, and it produced 1.03 million digital cameras and 94,000 digital video cameras. The plant is Canon's only manufacturing base in the Chinese mainland for digital cameras, digital video cameras, image sensors, and lens. The announcement came in a conjunction with a CEO statement regarding Canon's new strategy. It is natural that mirrorless cameras will become the mainstream of digital cameras. The market needs are accelerating, shifting to mirrorless cameras. In line with this, we are steadily shifting manufacturing, said the Canon's chairman and CEO when he explained about the decision not to release a new digital SLR flagship. Canon's decision to close its main factory in China demonstrates its new strategy regarding the imaging systems division. The assumption here is that Canon is going to focus on its pro mirrorless lineup and lens on digital DSLs and point-and-shoot cameras. Canon knows that high-end mirrorless models like the EOS R5 and the EOS R3 is a very promising niche that will not be intimidated by smartphones. Nevertheless, the high price tag makes these products to be relevant to pro users only. Not so sure if Canon wants that. However, we'll see a significant reduction in the number of camera models Canon offers to market. Japan's top-selling cameras in 2021. Couple of surprises. The end-of-year report for Japanese camera sales in 2021 has been published, and, surprisingly to say the least, no digital SLRs, Nikon, or full-frame cameras reached the top 10 in sales. While we hear the most noise about the biggest, newest, and most expensive cameras, it's worth noting that often those are not the most popular in terms of what people actually buy. The list itself was compiled by Japanese body BCN Retail, and the data accounts for around 40% of Japan's sales market, including the nation's major camera retailers. The list is largely dominated by APS-C and 4/3 cameras, many of which are 3 or 4 years old. The only new camera to make the list is the Sony ZV-E10, which is again a smaller mirrorless APC camera. The other interesting feature is the distinct lack of any Nikon brand cameras appearing in the top 10. Could it be that, in Japan at least, people are preferring smaller, lighter, more casual cameras that fit a content creator's lifestyle, as opposed to a serious professional photographer outlook, whatever that is? Perhaps the one thing that we shouldn't be so surprised about is the price point of these cameras. Most are between $600 to $800, which for the majority of enthusiasts and people wanting to take good pictures but not wanting to invest in a fully pro-level camera seems like a decent balance of price to value. The writing is on the wall that the days of the big chunky digital SLRs are numbered, at least for the average photographer. Semiconductor shortage affects Canon toner cartridges, forcing users to bypass warnings on their printers. The semiconductor shortage is now affecting printers, and this actually comes as no surprise, as several computer components such as graphics cards, processors, and more have seen shortages over the last year. However, the fact of Canon telling users to bypass the error messages from the printer due to it being unable to recognize the cartridge, making the system believe it has a counterfeit cartridge, does open up compatible cartridges from other manufacturers to be used, of course, if available at a lower cost. Canon instructs customers on how to bypass future crucial component-less toner cartridges, opening up to non-Canon cartridges to be used in place of the company's models. Canon is now apparently producing toner cartridges without copy protection and sending out emails to customers with instructions on how to bypass error messages about counterfeit cartridges. The German branch of Canon's website brings to light the semiconductor problem and offers a temporary fix until parts become available. This is part of the official press release from Canon. We value you as a customer and consistent user of Canon products. Due to the ongoing global shortage of semiconductor components, Canon is currently facing challenges in sourcing certain electronic components used in our consumables for our multifunctioning printers. These components perform, for example, functions such as detecting the remaining toner level. To ensure continuous and reliable supply of consumables, we have chosen to supply consumables without a semiconductor component until normal supply resumes. While there is no negative impact on print quality when consumables are used without electronic components, certain additional functions such as toner level detection may be affected. Gee, this is a grand opening for third-party providers of toner cartridges. IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Complaints for IT, Part 3 of 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. It's time for us to discuss your complaints, your top five complaints for IT departments, your IT department, whoever it is you're dealing with in IT, whether it's customer support or whatever. And I'm really focusing a lot on the corporate IT departments through all of this. But we started off with the help lift desk. We then went on to My Kid Knows More Than You. And this week, I want to take it to something a little bit less insulting. To, yes, the frequent password changes, the whole idea of complex passwords. And, oh, yes, you get locked out for, oh, I used a capital Q instead of a lowercase q in my password. So sue me. And then you locked out my password. Now, look, an IT department is responsible for controlling the information through technology that your company has. And, you know, you may work for some company and you may say that, oh, what we're doing here is not a matter of national defense. I don't know why you're all concerned about this. You're just going too far. I heard that. I've heard that many times before. I've heard that in many different companies, including a company that I worked at, where the company was in aerospace, and half of the items, half of the parts that we were making for planes were military parts. They were going to military aircraft. They were going to the aircraft that supports our soldiers who are overseas, who are fighting for our country. So, yes, it was a matter of national defense. And yet I still heard it. So why do we do frequent password changes? We do frequent password changes because what happens is Mike, no offense to Mike, he's actually a great guy, but Mike, he puts his password on a post-it note and he attaches it to his monitor. And even though I go by his desk and I remove that post-it note and it disappears into the ether, he still complains because he can't remember his password. We finally came across an arrangement with him. I said, put it into your wallet. I don't care if you get your wallet out and you check your password on the wallet, but you usually have your wallet with you. That's how you're going to secure things, because putting it on a post-it note in one of the rooms that is accessible to the outside, people are walking through here all the time, that's not a good thing. If an auditor sees that, we're in trouble. And then we ask for complex passwords. We ask, as far as IT, we ask for our complex passwords because, yes, if you type in five A's, A-A-A-A-A, 12345, that's not a password. That's not protecting the company. That's not protecting the data. That's not protecting anything. And if you think, let's go back to one of the flaws in the thinking here. If you think that your company, you know, we just sell food, and you have competitors, and they would love to get your magic formula on higher profits, lower costs. They'd love to get your customer list. There's all kinds of information that they want. Everybody wants information. Every company, if it's being run right, Every company is not really in the job of selling widgets. It's the job of controlling the information in regards to how that widget is made, how that widget makes the company money, how that widget gets sold to other people, who that's getting sold to, and, oh yes, all of the information in regards to every other widget that's within the company. It's important that we contain this information. So complex passwords, numbers, letters, special characters, uppercase and lowercase, all of these mixed in. Now, if we could somehow wave a magic wand and find a way so that you didn't have to enter in some crazy password that's X743 pound sign exclamation 129, if we could do that, somebody would actually find a way around it. Somebody would break that. Somebody would make it so that they could get the information within your company. And as benign, as simple, and as mundane as you think it is, there is somebody within your company that says, no, this is the most valuable information our company has. Our competitors cannot get a hold of this. So if you enter in the wrong password, if you enter in the wrong thing, what's going to happen? Yes, your system's going to lock out. And then you have to call IT, and they're going to support you, and they're going to help you with that lockout. You do it too many times. You lock yourself out too many times. Somebody comes along and counsels you. And you don't want to get counseled by the people who are trying to defend the information. You don't want to be counseled by the people who think that this information is very valuable, because that says that you don't understand the business well enough. And if you don't understand the business well enough, maybe you should find a new business. It's kind of creepy, but I've had to have that conversation before, and it's never, ever comfortable. From my side, from the IT side, imagine from the employee side. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Under the Radar is a full-function, 100% free tax preparation application. Credit Karma was founded in 2007 and introduced its tax service in 2016. Smart Credit Karma Tax is a full-function tax preparation application comparable to Intuit's TurboTax Home and Business. Credit Karma Tax is 100% free. It's free to file both state and federal tax returns. Credit Karma Tax is now Cash App Taxes. The URL for the account is https://cash.app/taxes. The Cash App Taxes team is the same crew from Credit Karma Tax. Starting in January of this year, you'll be able to get your tax returns that you filed with Credit Karma Tax within Cash App Taxes. What happened to Credit Karma Tax? Intuit acquired Credit Karma in February of 2020, and the Justice Department rightly required Intuit to divest the Credit Karma Tax program from Intuit. Credit Karma Tax was acquired by Cash App in November of 2020. After helping Credit Karma customers file their taxes for one last tax season, Credit Karma Tax is now Cash App Taxes, and it's still 100% free. If you had filed with Credit Karma Tax before, you have access to all your accepted past returns. Cash App Taxes is built and supported by the same people that brought you Credit Karma Tax. They have a new look and name, but some things will remain the same. Whether you filed with Credit Karma Tax in the past, or you're filing your taxes for the first time, Cash App Taxes will be ready for the 2021 tax season. Can they still access your past tax returns filed with Credit Karma Tax? Yes. Is Cash App Taxes still free? Yes, 100% free. They have a new name and home, but Cash App Taxes is still Credit Karma Tax, including being completely free from start to finish. Is Cash App Taxes still offering free audit defense? Yes. When you file your 2021 federal and state taxes, just in case you ever need it, Cash App Taxes provide free audit defense at no cost. Free filing, free guarantees, and free audit defense. Cash App Taxes is 100% free. It's really free. To use Cash App Taxes, you need to download Cash App from cash.app/taxes and create an account. Now, I came across Credit Karma Tax back in 2019, and I decided to prepare my 2018 income tax return with both TurboTax Home and Business alongside with Credit Karma Tax. I have many different forms to be prepared and had been using TurboTax Home and Business because of the multitude of forms required by the Internal Revenue Service. I did not qualify for any of the free tax programs that are sponsored and supported by the Internal Revenue Service. When using TurboTax Home and Business and Credit Karma Tax, they generated near identical reports. The exception is TurboTax allows the preparer to enter the data down to the exact cent. In the case of Credit Karma Tax, the data is rounded to the nearest dollar. The net difference was just a few dollars. It made no difference in how much tax I had to pay. I filed the TurboTax version electronically for 2018. The following year, I again prepared my return with both systems. Both applications matched up, and I filed this return for 2019 prepared by Credit Karma Tax. I had no problems. For the 2020 return, I just used exclusively Credit Karma Tax. So how did these two packages compare with each other? Credit Karma Tax preparation is with only one state return. If you work in one state and live in another, you have to add the additional state tax manually. Not all state returns are available from Credit Karma Tax. They may now be available for 2021 returns. TurboTax generates the estimated quarterly tax forms for the next year. With Credit Karma Tax, you have to calculate the estimated quarterly payments manually and download the forms from irs.gov. TurboTax generates reports comparing your return with others at the same income level. The Intuit reports also provided a historical return history with past years. Intuit Home and Business and Cash App meets all Internal Revenue Service report filing requirements. If you need the extra state return or the automatic generation of estimated quarterly returns or the nice-to-have analytical reports, then you may want to use TurboTax Home and Business, which cost somewhere between $65 to $75 from various stores. LibreOffice adds two new languages in version 7.3, Klingon and Indo-Slavic. I hear you laughing. LibreOffice is the continuation of the OpenOffice project, which had to change its name because Oracle claimed a trademark on the old name. If you're still using OpenOffice, don't. It's basically dead. Download LibreOffice, uninstall OpenOffice, then install LibreOffice instead. It's completely compatible because it's the same program, just a more modern version, smaller, faster, less buggy, and more secure. As for languages, the website already lists 51 and more coming. That's a tiny fraction of the world's 7,000 plus languages. And a language goes extinct every 2 weeks. For small communities trying to keep minority language alive, being able to write in it is very important. So if a bunch of volunteers wants to translate an app into Klingon, why not? It's fun. It could help other such efforts. Klingon has its own alphabet, and so can reveal problems with support for rare character sets and give learners extra motivation seeing actual useful software working in the language. As for Indo-Slavic, all nouns have two plurals or more, and it's written with 42 letters. It's also the only language with invisible diacritic marks, which are not written, but you must pronounce. 400 million people speak them, and once you know one of them, the others are much easier. The idea of Indo-Slavic and its commercialized sibling, Slovio, is to be a simpler, more regular Slavic language without the thousands of exceptions and special rules that naturally evolved languages have, so foreigners can learn something easier first. Constructed languages are no joke. Maybe only a couple of dozen people speak fluent Klingon, but 2 million people speak Esperanto. Don't knock that. And I remember growing up, one very popular fictitious language was Pig Latin. Mozilla to track Facebook, tracking you. Aside from the privacy practices that Facebook uses to track your every move on its platforms, the companies also come up with plenty of sneaky ways to keep tabs on you, off its sites as well. A new study wants to fight back against these off-site trackers by tracking them back. Researchers at Mozilla announced this week the launch of its Facebook Pixel Hunt study, which seeks to track the company's immense web-wide tracking network and investigate the intelligence it's collecting on users. This study is focused on a piece of tracking tech known as Facebook Pixel. Chances are you visit a site that uses it. These tiny pieces of tech are buried in literally millions of sites across the web, from online stores to news outlets. In exchange for onboarding a free pixel on their site, these sites can then track their own visitors and micro-target ads with the same sort of precision you expect from a company like, of course, Facebook. In exchange for giving these sites the power to track every page view, purchase, search, query, and much, much more, Facebook naturally requires that this data be shared with it too. Where the website visitor has an account on some Facebook platform, this off-site data just gets glommed onto whatever Facebook already knows about that person. If you don't have a Facebook account, then the company collects that data anyway and uses it to create a shadow profile of that particular person. These are the sorts of shadowy practices that Mozilla team wants to research with this study. And if you can help them do it, and of course, if you're a Firefox user. Mozilla teamed up with reporters from The Markup to gather details about Facebook tracking using a free-to-download browser extension, Mozilla Rally, that will hoover up data sent out by Facebook pixels as you browse across the web. The extension also keeps track of the time spent on different web pages, the URLs that the browser visits, and more. Mozilla was quick to note in its announcement that the only data being exported from the extension will be de-identified and not shared with any third parties besides The Markup's reporters. The study is in line with some of the previous crowdsourced work that Mozilla's done in the past. Most recently, it partnered with researchers at Princeton University to track how different users tap into political news stories or stories about the ongoing pandemic. Cyber criminals are mailing out USB drives that install malware. The malicious USB stick trick is old, but apparently is still widely popular, being used with the crooks. The FBI warned that a hacker group has been using the U.S. mail to send malware-laden USB drives to companies in the defense, transportation, and insurance industries. The criminals' hope is that employees will be gullible enough to stick them into their computers, thus creating the opportunity for ransomware attacks or the deployment of other malicious software. The USB drives contain so-called bad USB attacks. Bad USB exploits the USB standard's versatility and allows an attacker to reprogram a USB drive to, for example, emulate a keyboard to create keystrokes and commands on a computer, install malware prior to the operating system booting, or to spoof a network card and redirect traffic. The hacker group behind this bad behavior, it's a group called FIN7, F-I-N-7, and they have gone to great lengths to make their parcels appear innocuous. In some cases, packages were dressed up as if they were sent by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, with notes explaining that the drives contain important information about COVID-19 guidelines. In other cases, they were delivered as if they had been sent via Amazon, along with a decorative gift box containing a fraudulent thank you letter, counterfeit gift card, and a USB. The culprit, Fin7, is a notably sophisticated cyber criminal group that has also been connected to prominent ransom families such as DarkSid and Black Matter. The USB drives were configured to register as a keyboard device after being plugged in. They then injected keystrokes into the target PC to install malware. Numerous attack tools were installed that allow for exploitation of PCs, lateral movement across the network, and installation of additional malware. The tools were used to deploy multiple ransomware strains, including Black Matter and Art Evil. Black Matter is believed to be a rebrand of the DarkSid ransomware group, which appeared to close its business after attacking fuel distributor Colonial Pipeline in May. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, January the 27th. Meeting start time is 6:45 p.m., and it's a virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC's Users Group meets Thursday, February the 4th. Their meeting time starts at 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, February the 5th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi. The website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, February 10th. Meeting time is at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, February the 11th. Meeting start time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you had problems signing on to prn.fm, try prn.live. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch, and remember to do your regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.